substituted for I have to. For example, you say, I have to finish my work. And your partner replies, you want to finish your work. This works for just about anything. I can show you how much your own choice and desire play a role in decisions that you think are imposed on you. For example, I have to breathe turns into I want to breathe. What? I do have to breathe, you might say. That's true, if you want to stay alive. You have the option to commit suicide and stop breathing. Choosing to continue to breathe is a good tactic if you want to stay alive. Your turn. To get the flavor of this, change have into want in your mind the next few times you say, I have to. Do this silently, simply repeating to yourself the sentence that you just said out loud with just the one word changed. This exercise is very effective in getting people to realize that what they do in their lives, even the things they find unpleasant, is in fact what they have chosen. Occasionally, someone gets stuck on an item or two. A good example of this is what happened with my good friend Uzger. While he was a student in my course, he could not bring himself to say that he wanted to take the math courses that were a required part of his master's degree program. In fact, he knew he definitely did not want to take them, and certainly wouldn't take them if they were not required. After graduation, he went to work in industry for a year, and then returned to Stanford to do his PhD. One of the first things he did upon his return was to seek me out and invite me for a Turkish dinner in San Francisco. He told me at dinner that even though he still found the master's degree math requirements odious, he realized he actually had wanted to take those courses because the benefit to him considerably outweighed the discomfort. It was worth the wait for me. I love Turkish food, and that meal started a tradition in which, over the next few years, we sampled every Turkish restaurant in the area. Even if Uzger had not had the belated realization about the math requirement, the have-to-want-to exercise would still have made its point for him. It is important to realize that everyday life is not an exact science. In some fields, such as mathematics, a single counterexample is sufficient to prove that something does not work. By contrast, my view of life is that if you do something and it works almost all of the time, then you might as well take it as a guideline. If Uzger had examined his entire life and the only thing he found that he had to do and did not want to do was the math requirement, then he might as well live his life as though he wanted to do everything he did. Have you ever heard the phrase, the exception proves the rule? Well, if you have to struggle to find a single exception, you might as well live your life as though the rule is valid. Can't, won't. Next, let's look at I can't and test it against I won't. A good way to make the test is to use the same procedure as in the previous exercise. So, for example, if you say out loud, I can't stop breathing, you would then say to yourself, I won't stop breathing. The simple change of can't to won't is often empowering. Can't implies helplessness. Won't signifies volition and choice. Similar word change exercises worth doing are I need changed to I want and I'm afraid to changed to I'd like to. Try these out the next time you notice yourself saying I need or I'm afraid to. These simple substitutions make a difference. They add empowerment to how you feel about yourself and your actions. Help and should. Two other words that are good to discard or minimize the use of are help and should. If you think about help versus assist, the difficulty with the use of help becomes clear. When you help someone, you may be treating her as though she is helpless and only you are capable. By assisting someone, you are treating her with dignity and saying that she too is capable. Assisting is empowering language. Helping can at times be disempowering language. Similarly, should is a disempowering word. It implies doing something under obligation, sort of a have to rather than a want to. The exercise that I like to do with this word entails having one member of a pair utter a sentence that starts with, I should. The partner then responds, what is a should? After about 2 minutes of this nonsense, the should person gets the idea, and it's time to switch roles so that the partner can realize the absurdity of most shoulds. It's almost as much fun to do both sides of this exercise yourself. Why questions? Avoid asking why questions when possible in interpersonal communications. When you ask someone why he did something, the word has a slightly negative, disapproving connotation, making him feel a need to defend himself. Instead, state your position clearly, using I statements, instead of asking, why did you choose Jane as your co-leader? Say, I felt hurt that you didn't choose me to co-lead. Straightforward, honest conversation saves time and achieves your goal effectively. In this example, the answer to why Jane was chosen might be any good reason, and it most probably would not give you an opening to say that your feelings were hurt. Questions in general. Factual questions, questions of opinion, and rhetorical questions are the most common questions used in normal conversations. It's important to realize that not all questions are genuine ones. Most people know there is no real question behind the customary greetings, how are you today? Are you having a good day? And how are you feeling? People are not expecting a real answer. These seemingly meaningless questions demonstrate goodwill and can be used to acknowledge another's humanity. When I'm asked these questions by strangers, I usually assume goodwill on their part and play the game by answering as expected. However, it is harder for me to behave when the other person is obviously pre-programmed as part of her job. On one occasion, the devil possessed me. I had the following conversation with a checkout clerk at a supermarket. She, how are you today? Me, I'm dying of cancer. She, that's good. Me, have a good day. Clearly, she did as expected, and did not care about or even listen to my answer. In addition to using questions as greetings, some people regularly ask them simply to fill space. They feel the need to say something, so they ask a question. Like the checkout clerk, they don't really care about the answer. Their attention goes elsewhere, and they don't actually even listen to it. Sometimes they deliver another question before the other person has finished answering. In these cases, the specific question is clearly irrelevant. If the questioner does not care about the answer, it is not a genuine question. In a teacher-student or boss-worker relationship, questions can also be used as status symbols. If I'm the teacher and students ask me questions, then it shows that they respect me. They want to know my answers. They think I'm smart. Right? Or it could really be the reverse. They want to be seen as asking smart questions. Ever see someone blather on and on at a meeting using big words under the guise of asking the speaker questions and suspect she wants the people in the room to hear what she herself has to say? A person who is told, that's a good question, gains status. Being seen engaging with a person of authority on a seemingly equal plane can be the whole goal. One summer, I taught a class for young researchers at a Bulgarian resort on the Black Sea. I was looking forward to the farewell party on the last evening after a long week. When I arrived at the party, it was already in full swing. I headed for the drinks table and poured myself a glass of wine. When I turned to face the room, everybody was sitting on the floor and looking at me. I asked the professor in charge what was happening. He told me they wanted to ask me questions. Spending the evening answering questions was the last thing I had in mind. Yet, I didn't want to be rude. I felt I had to be responsive. So, I asked all who had questions to raise their hands. It looked like everybody had a question. For a moment, I saw my hopes for a pleasant evening of debauchery fading away. Desperate, I asked that they all close their eyes and imagine they were talking to me, asking me their question. Then, I asked them to imagine me answering their question. Finally, I asked them to open their eyes and raise their hands if they did not get an answer. No one raised a hand. So I said, good, everyone stand up and let's party. I am to this day convinced there were no genuine questions in that room. They had had all week to ask me whatever they wanted. I am especially pleased that I did not let whoever set up that question scenario hook my ego. Whatever answers they gave themselves did not get in the way of all of us having a genuinely nice evening. For it to be a genuine question, the questioner needs to be seeking information. For example, what is your name? What time is it? And what's the quickest way to the airport? All appear genuine. Yet we cannot be sure unless we find out whether the questioner really cares to know the information. What is your name could just be a space-filling question. What time is it could be flirtation. What's the quickest way to the airport could be your coworker's way of trying to get you to ask about the exciting trip she's about to take. Some questions are powerful in that they promote a transformative interaction. If, when you ask about something, you intend to get yourself and others thinking about it, you are asking a generative question. If, in addition, you genuinely care about it, such questions are both genuine and generative. They promote a dialogue in which all parties are listening to others and are fully engaged. The questioner does not simply get back the right answer. The question promotes a conversation between the answerer and the questioner that alternates between inquiry and advocacy. Truly generative questions are productive for all concerned. They result in much more than simply passing on known information. Achieving is often tied to interpersonal relationships. In short, we're better together. When your coworkers and superiors respect you, you tend to go farther. When your friends feel you genuinely care, you form more lasting and meaningful friendships. Even on a subconscious level, people pick up on it when you're asking throwaway questions. Don't fill the space with them. If you're going to ask your coworker, "How's your day?" be present for the answer. Context. The context of your words has a big influence on how they are meant and how they are received. I have had the experience of saying something to someone and then being surprised when I learned that they had heard something completely different. My wife and I were leaving a party at the Stanford Faculty Club. As we walked out the front door, Ruth said to me, "Boy, am I glad to get out of there." Ron, my department chairperson and the host of the party, was directly behind us and overheard her remark. He said, "Ruth, it wasn't that bad, was it?" She then had to explain that her shoes were killing her and she could not wait to get to the car to take them off. She assured him that she had very much enjoyed the party. It was the truth. I'm not sure to this day if Ron really believed her. Although there are many causes for misunderstanding, one of the most important is the context in which the communication takes place. In teaching, the misalignment of context is one of the biggest causes for misunderstanding. Just as with Ruth and Ron, the student may be talking about her shoes while the teacher is hearing about the party. Clearly, the same words have totally different ideas behind them unless the context is shared. In class, I find that a good way to make sure we all share the same context is to have students ask questions about the course material. Periodically, I require students to ask questions. If the class has 20 or fewer students, I require each one to ask a question. For larger classes, I just take a random sample. I am often blown away by how different some students' contexts are from what I had assumed. I'll have them ask any question, the dumber the better, and find out that some of them have been completely misinterpreting the lessons. This is a great tool for getting everyone into the same context before anyone gets too lost to recover. I do a lot of work with colleagues from different disciplines and countries. There again, contexts are critical for meaningful conversations. Many years ago, I introduced a course titled Computer-Aided Design. My close friend and colleague, Doug, wanted to sit in. We both have strong mathematics backgrounds, mine from researching mechanical systems and his from researching chemical systems. We're both quite informal and open with each other. I don't think the students had ever before or after experienced one professor lecturing and the other sitting in the audience and periodically calling out, "Bullshit." After class, we realized that we had not been in a shared context. The same words had very different meanings in our respective fields. Doug and I had a good time, and the show energized the students, so it all turned out well. If we had not had direct and open lines of communication, it could have been a disaster. Conversations. In verbal communication, both the lyrics and the music count. but people often don't give the music enough credit. Even something as simple as the yes-no exercise can trigger a whole range of different experiences. The exercise can be done in an angry way, a boring way, an exciting way, an amusing way, a teasing way, a bland way, a seductive way, and a loving way. The moral is that the music can be more important than the lyrics. It can also be the case that the lyrics don't really matter. The lyrics in many pop songs, for example, are there to create a mood and to engage us. They are not meant to be taken literally. Similarly, complaining about our situation is a great way to attract people's attention and get them interested in us, even if we don't really want their advice. What happens if you complain or gripe to your friends and they give you some advice? Do you thank them and take their advice? Or do you respond with, "Yes, but..." If you do the latter, then it is a fairly strong sign that you just want to be heard and aren't interested in solving the problem. This works both ways. So if you help friends solve their problems by giving them advice and they respond with, "Yes, but..." It's a good sign they don't want your help in solving their problems. They simply want to be heard. They want to vent and share. They want you to listen to their song. The proper response, then, is a sympathetic ear and your affirmation of their feelings and experience. I am always amused by my wife's friends giving each other advice to take an antihistamine for cold-like symptoms. These are women who have raised children to adulthood and been through countless colds and other common illnesses. They just want to complain. They don't need or want their friends' medical advice. They want a little sympathy. Mainly, they need the connection with their friends because their own grown kids don't talk to them anymore. Then there are the different communication styles. One of our adult sons is usually not interested in the prolonged telephone chats his mother prefers. This caused hurt feelings at first. Now that they have worked out a system, if he really doesn't want to chat, he tells her, "This is a business call." He is even allowed to change the designation mid-call. It has gone a long way toward getting each of them comfortable with each other's different conversational needs. You can learn to do this with colleagues as well. Rather than going on and on, make sure you give the other person an out. Say things like, "I can just give you the summary if you're busy," or, "Do you want to hear about this now?" I have a close friend who loves to home in on one person. He will get deeply engrossed in conversation with someone next to him at a dinner party. Often the other people at the table feel ignored. Furthermore, his conversation consists mainly of him talking, often telling stories of his adventures. Some years ago, we were at a large party, and I noticed he spent the entire evening talking to a woman I did not know. The next day, he remarked that it was a very enjoyable party. I asked him about the woman he was talking with. He knew virtually nothing about her. He had spent the entire evening telling his own stories. The mystery woman was, obviously, a good and patient listener. I know a married couple who love to share with their friends the details of every casual encounter they have. They call this debriefing, and it seems to give them great satisfaction. It enhances the original experience for them and assists them in reliving their adventures. It's also an important way for them to relate to others. I, on the other hand, find that giving lots of details about my experiences is much less satisfying than just savoring them in my own mind or writing about them. So when someone asks me to debrief, I intentionally mishear their request as "be brief." Of course, I too have a need to connect and share my humanity, however. With me, it usually turns out that less is more. Even people with very different styles can still communicate effectively. For example, my wife, our children, and I all have different communication styles. Yet we do make it work. If you don't have a lot of experience communicating with someone, it is difficult to always know the appropriate way to get your message across. Each new circumstance presents its own challenges. Here are some guidelines that I have found useful. 1. First, speak from your own experience and feelings as much as possible. In that way, you take direct responsibility for what you are saying, and that makes it hard for others not to follow your lead and take responsibility for what they are saying. In judging others, you need to realize that you are simply giving your opinion. It's best to always speak from how it makes you feel or what you personally believe. Do not generalize or universalize your personal judgments. Make I statements. 2. One of the most difficult things is to listen to someone else's story and not interrupt. Many people interrupt because they have something that they are afraid they might forget or that will not be relevant later. The best thing to do is to let it go. If it's still appropriate at the end, say it then. If it gets lost and remains unspoken, no matter how brilliant it would have been, the world will not notice. 3. The next most difficult thing when you are a listener is not to follow immediately with one of your own stories. It may not be as relevant to the topic as you think, in which case the person who told the original story will feel you did not really listen or get the point of her story. Alternatively, if your story is on point and a better story, it will seem that you are playing at one-upmanship. The other person's story loses relevance, and she feels diminished, not supported by your story. I have a good friend who, after many years of marriage, went through a divorce. As soon as he separated from his wife, he went around to his close friends to inform them individually. Universally, his announcement was followed by the listeners' tales of past crises in their own marriages. Understandably, his friends, me included, were trying to make him feel that we understood. Actually, he felt he wasn't being listened to. In retrospect, I realize I would have been a much better friend if I put aside my discomfort and talked to him about his feelings, not my stories. The question of intention lies behind all communication. What is it that you intend to communicate? Simply saying something does not mean it has actually been communicated. I realized this very early on as a teacher. I would say something several different times, intending to make it clear that I was placing strong emphasis on it. Inevitably, if I asked an examination question about the item, I would get students saying, "It was unfair because you hardly touched on it in the lectures." This brought home the insight that the teacher's worlds and the student's worlds are very different, and that I have to take responsibility to make sure my communications have been received as intended. Even if all parties agree on what has been said, or even if there is a signed written agreement, it does not mean that everyone is really agreeing to the same thing. There are often honest misunderstandings. This takes place largely because people do not make sure their meanings, not only their words, are shared. Remember, successful communication takes both intention and attention. It requires the explicit intention that the meaning be shared, and it also takes the explicit attention to be sure it has been shared. Unless you have a strong experiential bond with someone, simply saying something is often not sufficient to really communicate it. Actors know that they cannot play a character well unless they know how that character thinks. Similarly, true communication is facilitated when all the parties know how the others think. Here are my top suggestions for good interpersonal communications. 1. Speak for yourself. Say, "I know," "I think," "I feel." "My reaction is," not "everyone knows." "We all think," "we all feel," "everyone's reaction was." It is much better to take responsibility for what you say than to attribute it to others. You hardly know what you yourself really think, let alone what others think. 2. Don't be judgmental. If you need to be judgmental, especially in an argument or a tense situation, speak for your own feelings and reactions, as in item number 1. 3. Acknowledge other people's issues. People want to know that you heard them. Acknowledge their problems only. Don't try to solve them unless they explicitly ask you to. They don't want your advice or to know about your similar experiences. They just want to know that you have heard their story. It's about them, not you. 4. Don't ask why questions. Make declarative statements about your position. Asking people why they do things puts them on the defensive. 5. Really listen. Even if you think you know what they will be saying, or you have heard it before, don't interrupt or tune out. Don't be in your head preparing your reply while they are talking. Be willing to lose your thought, no matter how brilliant it is. 6. When you are telling a story, be clear what your point is. Be prepared to be misunderstood and misinterpreted. If it really, really matters, make sure your message got across by having it replayed to you. 7. Make sure your communication is heard as intended. Go beyond just delivering the message. Have the intention and attention to get it heard the way you mean it to be heard. And finally, 8. Make sure you understand what is being communicated to you. Go beyond just good listening. Get to a point where you know the intention, not just the words. If you have any doubt, rephrase and repeat back what the person has just said. For example, "So what I'm hearing is," or "It sounds like you feel." Try to get to the core of what a person is asking for or feeling, and then check to make sure you have it right. This is also known as active listening, a phrase coined by Thomas Gordon. It may feel phony the first few times you do this. Frequently rephrasing and repeating what another person says is not what most of us normally do, yet it can be very powerful. When another person feels understood, you've given him a great gift. The hard conversations. Part of working well in any group is the ability to have hard conversations. It's easy to avoid having conversations that deeply go into your feelings and tough issues. Ironically, avoiding hard conversations usually makes things worse, not better. Properly conducted, hard conversations vastly improve matters and can totally change the atmosphere in a positive way. I have found this to be the case, both at work and at home. If one person takes the initiative, others usually follow. It's easy. All you have to do is say how you feel and what your concerns are, and make sure you aren't attacking the person. I still recall the feelings of excitement and positive group cohesion 30 years ago when, at a faculty meeting, the design division got up the nerve to tell our youngest faculty member that we wanted him to leave. It was clear he would never complete his PhD thesis if he continued working at Stanford as a lecturer. Everyone, including the person we were dismissing, spoke openly and from the heart. I have found over and over again that if one person speaks from the heart, others follow, and the group's feelings of community and commitment increase tremendously. On the other hand, if the discussions remain on a superficial and impersonal level, the feelings of frustration and alienation abound. Sociologists speak of realistic and non-realistic conflicts. A realistic conflict is a disagreement that is goal-oriented. That is to say, it's about something specific that the conflicting parties need to resolve. When such conflicts arise in well-functioning relationships, their resolution can lead to progress toward the goal. A non-realistic conflict is, at heart, about something other than what is being talked about. Its primary purpose, for at least one of the participants, is to discharge tension. It's not really about the goal of solving a problem. Such conflicts arise when there isn't real mutuality in the group. Instead, there is a pseudo-mutuality, wherein people pretend their relationship to the others is something that it isn't. They may be hiding a poor self-image or a sense of exclusion or jealousy. Whatever its root causes, they are suffering discomfort that builds up tensions. In provoking a non-realistic conflict, they are seeking a temporary discharge of their built-up tensions. Unless something is done about the root causes of the tension, such conflicts can only put a temporary band-aid on a bad situation. Good communication skills affect every area of your life. They can mean the difference between getting a job and not getting it, making an important connection with someone or not, and surviving public crises without too much damage to your reputation or becoming persona non grata. We elect presidents based more on their communication style than anything else. We value people who communicate openly and honestly, and we avoid people who don't pick up on social cues that we don't want to be cornered or kept on the phone for a half hour. The best communicator isn't necessarily the person who knows the fanciest words. It's the person who pays attention and makes others know that they've been heard. Group Habits. Chapter 7. Conversation while being driven in New York City by my friend Harold. Me. Harold, why don't you use your turn signals? Harold. I don't like strangers to know my business. Belonging to groups gives us an important way to express our humanity. Most of us are affiliated with many groups. In addition to family, we have groups of friends, professional, political, health, and school groups, and so on. The way you interact within those groups can change the way you feel about each situation and can enrich or screw up your life. In this chapter, we'll talk about making productive changes in your teamwork, physical space, body language, and communication to make groups work better for you. Working in teams. In my teaching and administrative roles as the academic director of the D School, most of my day is filled with different group experiences. In the D School, all classes must be team-taught. The way we do team teaching is different from any other team-taught courses at Stanford. We expect that the entire teaching team be present at every class and always be ready to participate. Although there have been some remarkable exceptions, most other entities at Stanford treat team teaching as a relay race. Each person does his run, then hands off the baton to the next person, leaving the race. We feel that if every member of the teaching team is participating, the students get a richer experience. My colleague Jim Adams loves this kind of teaching. He tells me, "I like team teaching so we teachers can trash talk each other, thereby giving the students a better insight into professors as people and the nature of their world." Unfortunately, most of my colleagues are not at Jim's level of enlightenment regarding the virtues of trash talk. Still, it does benefit everyone to have different viewpoints in the same room. An iconic example of the benefits of team teaching occurred when I received a phone call from Bill on the evening of our first class session. He and I were part of the teaching team for the class Transformative Design. I was thrilled to be working with Bill because he was one of my closest friends, a world-class designer who had designed the first laptop computer, and one of the three people who had founded the design consultancy IDEO. The phone conversation went as follows. Bill.
I was wondering what you thought about our class this afternoon.
Me.
I thought it was great. What did you think?
Yes, I liked it.
Great.
Do me a favor. Next time, give me your PowerPoint slides the evening before the class.
You already know what I'm going to say. Why do you need them?
It's not the content. I want to fix your fonts.
Are you kidding?
No.
2 evenings later, Bill and his wife, Karen, were at my house for dinner. I showed my PowerPoint slides to our wives. They are both designers and have great aesthetic sensibilities. They humored me by agreeing that my fonts were not bad. However, I knew Bill was right. I had sinned in multiple ways. He proceeded to point out the defects. Too many font styles. Too many different font sizes, no consistency of style, and, worst of all, I had not used the official D-School font. As soon as he finished, Karen dubbed Bill the Font Nazi. We all had a good laugh. The next week, I, of course, told the story to the class. That incident provided me with a mantra for the rest of the term, which was, "Fix up your fonts, or Bill will get on your case." It was all in good fun. A powerful lesson lies behind this incident, however. I was trained as an engineer. I am used to worrying primarily about the content. Bill was trained as a designer. Bad aesthetics made him viscerally upset. If I were teaching the class alone, the students would never have been exposed to the sensibility that Bill brought with him so naturally. The sharing of sensibilities and different points of view enrich the educational experience for students and for teachers, and this occurs when we bring teachers from different backgrounds into the same classroom. Needless to say, Bill prepared all the future PowerPoint slides handouts, and web postings for the class. Everything was elegantly done in the same style, using the official D-School font. I never fully recovered. Every time I look at fonts, I fondly remember Bill. I also curse him for all the extra time and effort I now put in, struggling to get my presentations close to his minimal level of acceptance. Student teams. We also require teamwork from the students. Most of our courses are based on project work from interdisciplinary student teams. We generally don't impose any structure on the ways student teams organize themselves. Again, this is different from the mainstream. Many other academic units dictate team structure and assign different responsibilities to the students within the team. Much of the faculty mentality that team members should be assigned specific roles seems to me to be analogous to what happened to me in the third grade when the teacher assigned a structure, thinking it would train us for the real world. In fact, it had the effect of deadening initiative, discouraging us from learning the skills we needed to be responsible and flexible enough to find the appropriate structure for each specific situation. Sharing a project requires a set of skills that are different from those used when working alone. Everything discussed in the Conversations section of Chapter 6 is applicable to teamwork. In addition, there is the added dynamic of multiple players. Generally, the students are organized into groups of about four, so it's possible for there to be various splits in the way students handle conflict. We sometimes get three against one, or one against three. We sometimes get two pairs, and sometimes one pair and two singles, or, in the worst case, four singles. Remarkably, most teams work out well, and conflicts usually get resolved in productive ways. We actually have a professional psychologist on staff. We call him the D-Shrink. And he promotes the idea that open communication leads to much better team performance. There are various theories on how to compose teams to match different personality and skill types. I find that the most important thing to be learned from studying about different personality types is the visceral acceptance of the fact that basic differences exist between people. People are different because they have different academic majors and because they also have different styles for learning and doing things. Each person needs to know that his way is not necessarily the only right way. This will serve him both on the job and in the family. You know by now how much I like jokes, right? Well, during a court case, after listening to the plaintiff, the judge says, "You're right." The defendant gets excited and says to the judge, "But, Your Honor, what really happened was..." And the judge then says to the defendant, "You're right." Hearing this, a spectator in the courtroom says, "Wait a minute, Your Honor, they can't both be right." The judge responds, saying, "You're right." The point here is that seemingly contradictory things can all be correct. Most real-world activities are not zero-sum games. Ways can be found in which everyone, and especially the team, moves forward. If it's done out of respect and caring, controversy is not a bad thing. It can even be a good thing. It's important that the controversy not get personal and damage the team's sense of mutual support and understanding. It's also important that everyone on the team have an intention to make things work. Things go awry when people have different levels of commitment and different goals for the team. When things do not go well, it's easy for some team members to become self-righteous. It is good to know the truth, and it is good to know that the truth in itself does not dictate any specific action. As was pointed out in Chapter 1, you give everything its meaning. So lighten up and assist the team to get the job done. Constructive criticism. In our workshops, we have adopted a system for criticism that I originally learned from the late George M. Prince in a Synectics workshop. The idea is to give criticism in a supportive way that promotes positive evolution of the student's work by saying two "I like" statements followed by one "I wish" statements. For example, I might say, "I like the way you took into account concerns about safety, and I like the way it looks." Then after a short pause, I would continue, "I wish we could find a way to make it smaller." The first thing to notice about this feedback is that there is no but between the I like and the I wish. They are separated by only a short pause, nothing else. The second thing to notice is that I wish is said in a way that encourages further refinement in a positive way. It enlists everyone who hears the comment, including the commentator, to work on figuring out a solution. The way not to say it would be, "It will not work, you made it too big." This is a blocking kind of statement, whereas the I wish version says, "Yes, and." This system for criticism of student work was used for many years in our product design program. Now it has become a fixture in the D school, where it is used for feedback to and from students. This type of evaluation is, in theory, done after each class session by the teaching team and by any students who wish to participate. In addition, sessions involving the entire class and teaching team are done during class every few weeks. Based on this, changes are made both to subsequent classes and future course offerings. The current version of the I like, I wish system does not limit the order or number of these statements. Sometimes a group does all the I likes first, followed by all the I wishes. A modified version has been introduced by people who don't follow the original idea behind the I wish. They use the I wish simply to state something they would like to change, without suggesting a direction for improvement. Then they add a third set of items given in the form of what if. These serve the function of the problem-solving aspect of the original use of I wish. Under this newer version, we might get feedback such as, "I liked meeting as a group," or "I wish we spent more time in our group," and then, "What if we met after class?" Personally, I am more comfortable with the original I like, I wish version when it comes to criticizing students' work. The I wish version works well when it's used to suggest areas for improvement, and has a positive pull similar to the question, "How might we..." Both, "I wish there was a way to accomplish blank," and "How might we accomplish blank," are good ways to get people to move forward in a proactive problem-solving frame of mind. Regardless of the version used, this feedback mechanism is effective. It's invaluable in the D school's quest for continual improvement in teaching. The students and teaching team like it, and it adds a feeling of community to the class. The same tool can be profitably used for constructive criticism in many situations. It is certainly not limited to student work or to academia. It can be usefully applied to both your personal and your professional lives. We once had a senior member of the teaching team who had never before taught at the D school and was used to the formal European academic tradition. At the end of the first class session, one of the Stanford professors explained to him that it was our custom to gather for an I like, I wish feedback session, and he agreed to join. However, when he realized that the session would also include students, he was taken aback. The idea of students telling him what they did not like seemed audacious to him. Still, he was a good sport and toughed it out. After a few such sessions, he became such a big enthusiast that when a class ran a little long and the other teaching team members wanted to forego the feedback session, he was the one who insisted they follow through with it. Styles and Cultures. My wife Ruth's book club agreed to read an early version of the manuscript for this book. One of the members, Marcia, sent me an email thanking me and telling me she liked what she had read. However, the "your turn" exercises scared her. That surprised me. "What about shy people?" she asked. That struck a note in me. It also brought back a terrible memory I had suppressed, probably my worst teaching error. I was teaching a graduate class on designing mechanical devices. That day we were covering a set of parts called a four-bar mechanism. I had assigned students to find mechanical devices in their environments and to take turns in front of the class presenting an analysis relating what they found to what we were studying. The presentations went along well until one student did her presentation without regard to the vocabulary we had been using in class. I pointed out her projected diagram, showing a four-bar mechanism operating the tail flap on an airplane, and asked her what that was called. She did not answer. I got angry and blurted out, "This is the fifth week of class. It is inconceivable to me that you would not be able to identify a four-bar mechanism. We have been talking about them twice weekly since the first class. Where have you been?" The woman did not say a word. She left in tears and never returned. She was from China, and it was especially humiliating to her that I had caused her to lose face in front of the entire class. As soon as I realized what I had done, I felt terrible. Week after week, I hoped she would return. To this day, I regret that I did not reach out and contact her. 2 years later, she showed up in a class I was co-teaching with Sherry Shepherd, designed to be supportive of women graduate students. Sherry was the only female professor in Stanford's Department of Mechanical Engineering at that time. We used some of the techniques presented in this book, and the class passed without incident. I noticed for the first time, however, how very shy this student was. I finally realized what a frightening experience being in front of the design class must have been. At the final feedback session, this student told me, "You were much nicer in this class than the last one." It relieved a bit of the guilt I carried from my previous insensitivity to her shyness. We have many foreign students at Stanford. Some come from cultures that are fairly aggressive, and they tend to fit right in. Many others come from cultures where students are taught to be passive receivers of knowledge and to consider faculty as unapproachable, almost as deities. For such students, and for naturally shy American students, the Silicon Valley culture can be especially trying. Behaviors such as self-promotion, group work, approaching strangers, seeking assistance, meeting with an instructor during office hours, and speaking up in class can be difficult for them. Nowadays, with people working, studying, and living in countries that were foreign to their forebears, analogous cultural difficulties exist in many parts of the world. This situation is especially worthy of attention when you have people from another culture who were born in your country or who speak your language. You must not assume that just because someone speaks your language well, she is comfortable with your culture. In interacting with others, it is important to look for the outliers and take into account their discomfort with what may seem very natural to you. Outliers can occur at both ends of the spectrum. I had a PhD student from Shanghai who was most unusual. In those days, before the economic upswing, most students from the People's Republic of China were supported by their government and lived frugally, worked diligently, and used bicycles or walked. They saved what money they could get to buy things to take back home. This young man did not fit the mold. He bought a car during his first few months. Then he started not showing up for our weekly meetings. When he did appear, I was not impressed by his output. I gave this student several minor reprimands, yet his behavior remained spotty. Finally, I'd had enough. Even though a close colleague in Shanghai had recommended him to me, it was time to end the relationship. I told him that I did not want to continue to work with him, and he should find another thesis advisor. He astounded me by telling me it was not fair to dismiss him in this manner. I asked him what he thought would be fair. He suggested a point system similar to that used by the Department of Motor Vehicles. Each offense has a specific number of points associated with it, and you lose your license only if your total exceeds a certain number of points. This was too amusing to turn down. We agreed on a system of points. Amazingly, he shaped up immediately after our agreement and never got close to having his license suspended. He finished in a reasonable time with a good thesis. After graduation, he found a job on the East Coast, got married, had a child, and never went home to China. On the other end of this spectrum, I find that when I go abroad, I am often the outlier. It takes a little courage to introduce a bit of interactive California teaching style. Once, I was with a classroom of students in a regional college near Mumbai. After I worked hard to break the ice for about 40 minutes, I got the students to open up and we had a nice interaction going. The director walked in and, after a few minutes of observation, decided he would help me. He loudly announced, "I request you do not interrupt the professor until after the lecture." If looks could kill. In any group setting, it's important to realize that not everyone thinks like you do, whether because of cultural differences or just differences in style. Aim to understand each other's communication preferences and learn from each other. When was the last time you... I have often had the experience that after students miss a class, they come to me for the lecture notes. My style is to lecture extemporaneously, so I don't really have a set of lecture notes to give the student. Instead, I've proposed what seems to me to be a perfectly reasonable alternative. I suggest that the students copy a classmate's notes, go over them, and then come to me to discuss anything they feel unclear about. Often it turns out that the students don't know anyone else in the class, and they're not sure who to ask about borrowing notes. It's as though students in the same class are ships in the night, passing each other with just enough recognition to avoid collision. My urge to assist students in breaking through this veil of anonymity was one of the factors that led me to create courses in which students interact with each other. In this context, I devised an exercise that has been very effective in getting people to connect. This connection helps to break through the ships-in-the-night phenomenon of people being in the same environment and not connecting. Airplane travel has evolved into a classic example of people spending hours together, including sleeping next to one another, without communicating. An effective group icebreaker is to divide the class into pairs in which each tells the other what type of person she is. This provides good experience in both talking and listening. The students then are asked to relate what they heard about their partner to a different group of partners. This is a good way for us to discover how poorly we listen and how little we remember. After the first introductions, a great way to connect with a large group is to form circles of 6 to 8 people and have them each take turns completing the same sentence. The sentences I use always begin with, "The last time I..." After everyone has completed his response to a given sentence, I introduce the next sentence to the group. This time a different person goes first, and when this round is completed, a new person begins the next sentence. I use a different human experience for each round. They thus end up completing sentences such as, "The last time I laughed was..." "The last time I cried was..." "The last time I had trouble sleeping was..." "The last time I did a good deed was..." "The last time I got angry was..." "The last time I did something brilliant was..." "The last time I did something stupid was..." "The last time I had a mystical experience was..." "The last time I stole something was..." "The last time I lied was..." "The last time I thought about suicide was..." And finally, "The last time I felt love was..." I have found this technique also works well with groups in settings outside the university. This is a very effective exercise on several levels. It gets people to find out a little bit about each other and to start to form connections with others in the group. It's also a way for people to see that we all share a common basis of experience. We all laugh, cry, lose sleep at night, and do things we are proud of, things we are not proud of, things we regret, and things we are ashamed of. That is all part of the human experience. We often hide parts of ourselves because we feel others would not understand or would disapprove. We are sure they don't do similar things. My experience is that students from all over the world have had similar emotional experiences. After all, we are all human. It goes a long way toward establishing trust when students tell their stories to each other. I arrange the room so that I don't hear the stories that go with the responses. I do this to emphasize that this is a student-to-student sharing experience. It always turns out that the more you reveal about yourself, the more people like you. It's ironic that we hide aspects of ourselves because we fear rejection. It's the hiding, not the revealing, that leads to rejection. Your turn. Apply these same ideas in a private conversation. Next time you're having a leisurely conversation, tell your acquaintance what type of person you think you are, and then ask her to tell you about herself. Then go on to share the last time you could not sleep all night, and ask your partner when that happened to her. From there, start trading stories about the last time you had a good laugh, the last time you made a bad mistake, and so on. At the end, notice how your relationship with the other person has been altered by the details you shared. The name game. Some people identify strongly with their names. Others hate their names, and many others are more or less neutral in their feelings. I have asked students to rate their feelings about their names on a scale from 1 to 10. I've gotten ratings all along the scale. I used to do a class exercise in which I asked the students to shut their eyes and think about the name that best describes who they are. Or if they feel they already have the correct name, to pick another one that just feels good. Then I asked them to mill around and interact with each other, staying in the persona that their new name implies to them. This is an interesting way to briefly try out